Hello, and welcome back to another edition of YCT Matters. This is Carol Platt Liebau, the president of Yankee Institute, and today we're joined by Ben Weingarten. Ben is editor-at-large at Real Clear Investigations and senior contributor to The Federalist, among other things. You may think his name sounds familiar, and it probably does, because you have seen his work at Newsweek and all over the place. And so, Ben, we are really delighted to have you join us. Thanks so much.
Well, Carol, thanks for having me, and it's a pleasure.
Ben, one of the many places that we saw your work is, of course, as we mentioned, at Real Clear Investigations, and you did this amazing piece on union release time, which, as you know, is of enormous interest to Yankee Institute, and I'm just thrilled that you are presumably not related to Randy Weingarten, who's, of course, the president of the American Federation of Teachers.
I'm not related in any way, shape, or form, I can confidently say.
Well, and I know you stand a little taller every time you get to say that. We were fascinated by the piece that you did this summer on the unions and their organizing time, and a lot of what you found, because as you know, Yankee Institute put out a paper several years ago called Union Time on the Taxpayer Dime, talking about union release time, which is where a union member can do union work and still be paid. And you did the same kind of work for the federal government, and a lot of it was really eye-opening.
Well, I appreciate that. And yeah, this concept of release time is something that was foreign to me, and I kind of came into it with fresh eyes through this work from the Freedom Foundation, which, as you sort of alluded to, had done really extensive FOIA-related work on demonstrating that Randy Weingarten, the head of the of AFT, the American Federation for Teachers, stood to make potentially at least a couple hundred thousand dollars in benefits that she effectively did not earn. She essentially was treated as and credited with time serving as a teacher, where in reality she was not serving as a teacher, but she was serving as a union boss. And this sent me down the rabbit hole of looking into union release time. And there are various ways in which it's described when it's in a federal context versus a state and local context. But to your point, this allows union employees, and this exists in the private sector and the public sector as well, but I think may shock the conscience of listeners more in the public sector, allows union workers to be treated as serving their actual jobs while in reality engaging in union activities. And this is supposed to be strictly limited to collective bargaining, negotiations or renegotiations, and other explicit external facing union work, not internal activities and certainly not political activities. But in reality, there's been evidence to suggest that it does lead to, in some instances, people not doing their actual jobs that taxpayers are paying for up to 100% of the time, and in that time, instead, engaging in union activities, which does not always hew to those standards of actually the typical collective bargaining, negotiations, and such. And at the federal level, this has been far more meticulously documented than at the state and local levels, but it still, to some degree, is at the discretion of the agencies who are doing the reporting. And there's sort of been on again, off again oversight at the federal level. During the Trump administration, there was an effort to rein in the concept of release time for federal employees. And obviously that was rescinded very quickly in the Biden administration, but the historical numbers have showing that around $100 million plus of taxpayer dollars each year go to paying federal workers to engage in union work over the actual jobs that we pay them to do. And again, this is based on sort of self-reporting for the most part. At the state and local levels, it's been estimated, and this is somewhat of an old figure, that there could be up to $1 billion worth of man hours, essentially, used, dedicated towards union time across the country. And what we have, as your institute has documented, is we have state level figures, sometimes that have been gleaned from FOIAing relevant authorities. But actually getting to an accurate answer here is incredibly difficult in terms of what is the total cost the taxpayers pay for public workers to go about doing their union activities? And then what do those activities actually entail? Are they in furtherance of essentially labor peace with the politicians? Or is it towards other ends, including political ends potentially? And then do we get into potentially taxpayer dollars being used to back a private organization in the form of a union and or to back political causes that the taxpayers themselves may not actually agree with, and that might actually cost them more money or hinder right. or alter the services that they pay for. And part of the problem here is that by the very nature of the public sector union agreements, to get to answers, you'd have to look into thousands of agreements probably across the jurisdictions across the country, many of which are opaque about what release time provisions might actually look like. And in many instances, authorities may not have accurate records showing who is working on release time, what percentage of the time, and on what activities. And that leads to the natural question of, is that by design or is that just the way the system has evolved? And so I go into all of this in fairly deep detail in this Real Clear Investigations piece. And I think this just shows one of the myriad conflicts that exist when you talk about public sector unions in general and calls into question whether or not their interests are actually aligned with the taxpayers who pay their salaries.
Well, Ben, at risk of being a cynic, I think a lot of the time what you see in government is safely described as planned opacity. It makes it very difficult for a normal person to actually get in there and really figure out exactly what is going on. And it is such a widespread phenomenon that it's hard to believe, I think, after all this time, that it is somehow completely unintentional. I know our study several years ago found that in 1 year, Connecticut employees spent 121,000 hours on union time while they were still being paid by taxpayers, and it cost $4 million. You know, it's interesting because in a sense, I mean, just breaking it down, which obviously outraged one of my dogs, really breaking it down to its basics, that's a form of stealing. A lot of taxpayers aren't really hiring state workers to work on union business. And at the heart of the Janus decision was the holding that what the union does in terms of its advocacy is inherently political, which is why the Supreme Court found that every state worker had the right to decide for him or herself whether or not he or she wanted to be in the union.
That's right. And, you know, clearly there's a staunch difference between the direction that the Supreme Court has moved with respect to public sector unions and where the states are. And it's one thing that's notable and that I found in reporting out this piece is how few state legislatures are actually doing, or first of all, seem to be even aware of this issue, and then are actually taking steps to remedy it. So there has been some legal action taken by essentially public interest law firms on this case. But at the legislative level, there have been very little action. It isn't as if any sort of public sector union skeptical think tank in every single state is filing FOIA requests and trying to develop the numbers and produce the documents that would be used to substantiate cases, or for someone in the state legislature or members or several members of state legislatures to draft essentially and put forth and fight for model legislation that could be widely applied across the country. And I think that's in part because people aren't aware of the issue. And then it's also in part, obviously, because the public sector unions are so inherently powerful. I mean, you have the obvious conflict of interest of, well, if there's not peace with the labor unions, then what public services will suffer potentially? And then beyond that, you obviously have the political power of these unions that can make or break a politician's career. And so on those two bases alone, and we can probably offhand think of many others, that creates a real difficulty for members of state legislators, even ones who might think that this is an unjust, immoral, and probably illegal sort of practice, to actually go about combating it.
I found it interesting that states like Florida, Montana, Ohio, and Utah, none of which we think of as far left union loving states, all considered legislation to limit union release time, and yet none of them could get over the finish line. And I mean, it is a testament to the power of government unions. And yet you have things going on even in a state like Missouri. I noticed in your report that government unions have used their release time. They were being paid by the people of Missouri. And again, as a native of St. Louis, I can testify that Missouri, now at least, it used to be a bellwether state, but now it is fairly solidly in the red column, that the government unions were using release time. In other words, they were on the taxpayer dime and lobbying public officials for legislation, including laws that were solidly opposed to employee free choice about things like joining a union, presumably. And so it is amazing that so much of this goes on. It seems like it really does fly under the radar quite a bit.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you were to try to combat this practice, the first thing is increase knowledge of it. And I do think that, you know, it's interesting. On the one hand, there is an argument that's being put forth that unions politically are more popular than ever. On the other hand, there's been a backlash against public sector unions, particularly education unions, during the era and the post, during the COVID era and the post COVID era. And that has caused even blue states or purple states that might otherwise, you know, be sympathetic to the causes of teachers unions to turn on them, in part because they see that those unions have served to the detriment of their children and impacted their lives directly. And so, you know, there's an, I think when it comes to public sector unions above all others, most Americans are probably generally sympathetic to the cause of labor, I would say, conceptually at least. But when it comes to you are paying a public worker to take action that undermines that dollar or that cuts against your conscience or your political beliefs, or in this case, just appears to be plainly unethical or to the detriment of a basic job, I think that does strike a chord with the public. And you would think it would encourage legislators and others to start taking action on it. But, you know, maybe it's that politicians have made a calculation that there are bigger fish to fry and other issues worth focusing on. But it's hard to imagine something that would more strike at the conscience than people being paid to do a job that is not the job they're actually paid for.
Yes. And, you know, it seems to me it's absolutely true that public employees, like any other employee, you know, have a right to advocate in favor of their own best interest. Where that right stops, it seems to me, is where the people they are presumably advocating in opposition to, that is the taxpayers, have to pay them, you know, are forced to pay them to do it. And so that's where it seems to me the rubber meets the road and what's so unfair about all of this. But speaking about people's First Amendment rights, that's another area, the First Amendment, where I know you have had a lot of work, covered a lot of different things, Ben. And I will you tell us a little bit about some of the First Amendment work you've done as well, because that's an issue very near and dear to our heart at Yankee Institute.
Well, thanks for that. And to me, the First Amendment related issues, the First Amendment is under assault in this country.
Indeed.
Period, full stop. And what that means is that any political cultural change that we might want to see happen is imperiled. If you can't have a free and vigorous and open debate on the issues, even without prior restraints, forget about criminalizing wrong things.
Yep.
We have a major problem. It's a first order problem of the highest magnitude, and all else is lost, in my view, essentially, to the extent that right is gone. And so I've been focusing on this theme in my writing and speaking for several years, of a war on wrongthink, which essentially says that views disfavored by our political elite are not only wrong and evil and nefarious, but are actually have a nexus to domestic terrorism, or would-be domestic terrorists. And we've seen this manifest itself in any number of contexts. I think for the first time, Americans probably got a taste of this when it came to the release of the Twitter files. But the Twitter files themselves have exposed something that many of us have long known, which is that views on any number of issues have been not only disfavored, but censored on social media. And we can see this in shadow banning, and then we can see this in outright bans and a whole slew of other kind of gradations of censorship, or causing people to self-censor. And obviously this exists not just on social media, but in the real world, in private and public life. The Twitter files highlighted something that had actually been really exposed in the Missouri v. Biden case, which is perhaps the case par excellence that Americans probably first became familiar with an amazing July 4th ruling this year, where Judge Terry Doty in that case essentially said that it appears as if the government writ large, many agencies across the government, has colluded and conspired and coordinated with social media companies to censor disfavored speech. Generally speaking, conservative speech, but not solely conservative speech. Dissenters of many political stripes on a variety of issues, starting with the Hunter Biden laptop story, moving to questions of election integrity in the 2020 race, expanding to virtually every aspect of COVID-19 from its origins through mitigation measures, and then expanding to a whole host of other issues as well. And that case, in my view, if you actually delve into the docket, shows you any number of smoking guns that make clear that essentially the social media companies were weaponized and deputized as government speech police. And Judge Doty essentially said that the plaintiffs in that case are likely to prevail on the merits of that argument, and that thus the government speech policing by proxy, this whole public-private right. censorship regime, as I've called it, ought to be frozen. There ought to be an injunction against it while the case was pending. That's obviously being heavily litigated. Essentially, the Biden administration is saying, well, no, you can't freeze the government speech police. How dare you try to do that, which is kind of a perverse argument on its face, but they've tried to make it in court. And so I've been trying to expose this in any number of ways. One of the key agencies that is at the heart of the federal government-led aspect of what I've called a censorship regime is CISA, a little-known sub-agency within the Department of Homeland Security. It's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, a mouthful. Many Americans may have heard about that because CISA declared the 2020 election the most secure election in American history. And then CISA's head was quickly jettisoned thereafter by President Trump. But CISA itself has been at the forefront of calling for the policing of speech and actually helped coordinate and facilitate the government-led speech policing effort under the guise of defending quote unquote critical infrastructure. And
yes,
this takes us down somewhat of a rabbit hole, but to describe it briefly, CISA was created in 2018 with the idea that it would defend our critical infrastructure, which all Americans would agree with is a charge that the government ought to have. CISA interpreted that defense of critical infrastructure, including around elections, to consist of actually defending the government narrative around the integrity of elections, which got into treating tweets questioning the integrity of our elections essentially as mini domestic terrorist attacks on our election infrastructure. And this isn't me editorializing it. This is what actually happened in practice. And this is in keeping with what the current head of CISA, Jen Easterly, has said. She has said that CISA's task is defending our critical infrastructure, and our cognitive infrastructure is the most critical infrastructure of all.
See, and that's the kind of verbiage that I find alarming and offensive, along with this whole new effort to dress up all of this as misinformation. It is not the government's job to police the information that comes to Americans, because they are not equipped to decide. We're not a bunch of children. They're not equipped to decide what sort of information we are allowed to hear and process. You know, the power to speak and the power to hear turns out to be the power to think. And as soon as they take that away from us, we, in a sense, they're the ones depriving us of the cognitive infrastructure we need to make our own decisions like adults do.
That's absolutely right. They believe that they ought to be the arbiters of truth. And even though, of course, the government, as we know, oftentimes itself has been proven to be the greatest purveyor of quote unquote mis, dis, and malinformation.
Yes, irony lives, doesn't it?
And having a monopoly on narrative and a monopoly on truth, of course, gives you a monopoly on power ultimately. And yes. So, as you note, they have essentially said, they, and I'm using they here to describe government agencies with the national security apparatus as sort of the tip of the spear, alongside academics and media companies and social media companies. They have determined what constitutes mis, dis, and malinformation. Malinformation, by the way, by the own definitions of relevant government agencies, being facts that lead people to understand a narrative that is in conflict with the narrative the government wants to propagate. So truth actually has to be outlawed. Mis, dis, and malinformation, they draw a line from that to national security threats, assaults on democracy, obviously using January 6th as a pretext in part to make this case that there's a nexus between mis, dis, and malinformation, for example, about elections. This inspires people to engage in domestic terrorist attacks, and thus that's used to justify censorship. That's sort of the line of thinking here.
Yes, and it's complete nonsense. And what's more, you know, it isn't their call. What I find interesting is it's this whole safetyism approach that we've seen creeping forward in a lot of areas for a lot of years. And while, you know, it's a remarkable distortion of the purposes of the First Amendment. While they're willing to gut core speech like political speech, you know, there is nothing too raunchy to go in books to be given to children. It's just an amazing distortion of what the First Amendment was intended for.
It's absolutely right. And obviously, this is increasingly extending to the medical field, you know, the sciences, and a whole slew of other fields as well. So, you know, the argument that I've put forth and that I've tried to instill, and I made this argument to Congress as well, because I testified before House Homeland Security Subcommittee on Oversight, Investigations, and Accountability, which obviously has jurisdiction over CISA and the rest of DHS, where, as you remember, they tried to create a disinformation governance board, DGB, so-called. The argument that I made is not a single dollar of our money should go towards silencing ourselves. And I think if that is a starting principle, that leads naturally to legislative remedies, as well as essentially using the power of the purse to defang and de-deputize the speech police. So essentially follow the money in terms of appropriations to every single agency involved in censoring Americans directly or by proxy in terms of colluding with the social media companies or these quote unquote third party academic research institutions who the government helped coordinate in some instances. And those organizations, and I'm thinking here in particular, the Election Integrity Partnership for starters, they actually surveilled en masse social media in the run-up to the 2020 election and then also during the COVID-19 pandemic and collected en masse potentially offending tweets and not just tweets, but also went to other social media companies and chronicled their posts as well that offended by putting forth certain narratives that were disfavored. They went to the social media companies and said to them, you really ought to take a look at your terms of service and think about crushing certain types of speech. And we're going to identify actually examples of that offending speech for you. And then, of course, that speech got quashed. The EIP itself appears to have been convened in consultation with CISA. And it was actually interns at CISA who were part of one of the organizations leading EIP at the same time, who's purportedly helped create this Election Integrity Partnership, which then morphed into and created the Virality Project, so-called, in conjunction with COVID-19 speech censorship. So also, you have to follow public dollars to those organizations as well. And members of the House, Republican members of the House, have started to scrutinize both the government speech police and then their private sector accomplices or co-conspirators, I would call them, in a conspiracy against the First Amendment, as well as obviously targeting the social media companies to find out what was done, when, and by whom, in coordination with these other actors. This regime is being exposed. And then the next question is going to be, ultimately, does it shut down? Does it launder its work? Does it hide it? Is it all the quote unquote private sector with no public funding behind the censorship efforts? But to your point, the core of this at the end of the day is this notion that started at the campus, but now has spread to the rest of the world, like all the worst ideas,
right?
Which is that speech we don't like is harmful and we will censor that speech under the guise of protecting public safety, public health, national security, et cetera. And obviously with that rationale, you can justify almost any usurpation of or violation of our rights. And this is kind of basic, you know, do we have a republic or not, sort of principles that we're talking about here. But it's all lost at this point because this false narrative has been set up that to save our democracy, we have to throw away our republic and all the principles on which it's based, because the public sometimes doesn't elect people that we agree with and elects people that might actually threaten our power and privilege.
Right. And as we wrap up, you know, I would just point out that underlying this whole argument is a complete lack of faith in the American people's ability to discern good arguments from bad ones, because standard First Amendment legal doctrine has been that the solution to bad speech isn't banning speech, it's more speech. And that's what these, you know, always beware people who want to turn off speech. It's people who don't have confidence that they can win a fair argument, a fair battle of ideas. They can't prevail in the marketplace of ideas, so they just want to shut down the whole marketplace. And that's exactly what we find with these people in the government. And it's not as though their record in being right fills one with confidence. So,
and even if they were right, it would still be wrong to impose their narrative, their views on us, and not only to censor, but then ultimately to get into the realm of criminalizing dissent, which is where we are today.
Yes. And the point I'm making is even they know that their arguments are worth nothing, which is why they're going to these extremes. It's they're not to be trusted. And certainly they have no right to rip apart a First Amendment that has served our country very, very well. Tell us, Ben, as we wind up, where we can find your work.
I would point folks to my Substack. It's winegarden.substack.com, which I use as a kind of clearinghouse for all of my work in a number of venues, like you noted, the Federalist, Real Court Investigations, Newsweek, the New York Post, and a whole slew of other places as well. And then I'm probably too active on Twitter, or I guess X, as it's now called. And my handle there is at BH Winegarden.
Ben, we can't thank you enough, and we look forward to seeing more of your work on Substack at Real Clear Investigations, The Federalist, Newsweek, and elsewhere. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. And so thank you for having joined us for this edition of YCT Matters. This is Carol Platt-Liebau, president of Yankee Institute, and we look forward to having you with us the next time.
I'll show you around this place I call home.